Turn, if you would, to 1 Kings, and God willing, we'll complete chapter 4. 1 Kings chapter 4, we continue to consider the wisdom of Solomon. On the last Lord's Day, we thought about his splendid material wealth. I'm going to read from verse 29 of 1 Kings chapter 4. And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart, like the sand on the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. For he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol. And his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Also he spoke of trees, from the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. And men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Amen. So verse 29 begins by reminding us where this wisdom has come from. It reminded us last week of where all the money came from. This time, his wisdom, his knowledge, his understanding. And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore. This is the wisest, cleverest man, apart from Christ himself, to have walked this earth. Those who are merely clever and intelligent often succumb to pride and haughtiness. Whereas truly wise men and women know and acknowledge that whatever they have and whatever they know, whatever they have learned, comes not from themselves, but from the great God of heaven. Furthermore, his heart is large. And that shows in the generosity with which he shared the tremendous wealth which has been previously described, and yet also its capacity to both store and distribute wisdom. And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding. And so naturally, the next verse says, Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. Why not the men of the North or the men of the West? Well, the North and the West back then were not famed for their wisdom. Egypt was, and Mesopotamia in the East certainly was as well. In other words, those two parts of the Middle East, which everyone talks of for their wisdom and their understanding and their learning, well, Solomon was greater than them. There are many sources of wisdom available, both in Solomon's day and in ours, all competing for airtime and your attention. There are many eloquent teachers of wisdom available, competing for attention and disciples. We have a similar situation when Paul is writing to the Corinthians. Teachers of wisdom, eloquent people have entered the church, teaching this, teaching that. But Paul says, but we preach Christ crucified. So the East almost certainly is a reference to Mesopotamia, the great civilization of the Sumerians and the Babylonians. It was considered a great place of scientific endeavor, scholarship and literature. The Epic of Gilgamesh is still in print, which was from that land. Egypt also was known for its great learning and its scholarship. Later on, it had the huge Library of Alexandria, though that had at this stage not been built. There are in Egypt those huge pyramids. I'd like to visit them one day, clearly not this year. Khufu, Khafre and Menkaure built those three great pyramids. But by the time Solomon is around, they're already 1,500 years old. A civilization which could build such architectural marvels and pay for them is surely a civilization worth knowing and emulating and admiring, but the writer is clear. The wisdom of Solomon was greater even than the great civilization which constructed those pyramids and those huge statues. In Acts chapter 7, Stephen says, and Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. And yet at that time, he was ignorant of the God of his own fathers. He forsook the treasure and the wisdom of Egypt when I am called him. How many today are clever and erudite and wise and learned and have letters after their name, published books, but they know nothing of eternal truth? The man or woman who can barely string together a sentence but knows the gospel is far wiser than the wisest scholar of earth. And the Egyptians were considered clever, as were the Babylonians, but spiritually, they were pig ignorant. The Egyptians, for all their brilliance, worshipped cats and wolves and falcons and crocodiles. Not creatures perhaps to mess with, but certainly not deserving of worship. The Babylonians worshipped the sun and the moon and the stars. I like looking at the stars. And I'm looking forward to seeing once again the sun. But let me assure you, such lights in the sky are not fitting for worship or adoration. What's greater, the creator or the created? If the sun and the moon and the stars are magnificent, how much more he who made them? And yet the he who made them, the Egyptians and the Babylonians, did not know. Not only is Solomon wiser than Babylon's wise men, but the implication here is that the God who makes him wise is far greater than the gods of wisdom of both Mesopotamia and Egypt. Enki, the god of Babylon, the god of wisdom, of the intellect, of magic Apparently he invented the plough, was responsible for making plants grow. But Solomon was greater than anyone who followed him, and Solomon's God was far greater than Enki. The Egyptians worshipped Thoth as their god of wisdom, the god of science and hieroglyphs, art and judgment. Where's Thoth today? He's simply found in the ground and in dusty museums. But the god of Solomon continues to reign. Jeremiah, speaking of Babylon's judgment in the 51st chapter of his prophecy, says of God, he has made the earth by his power. He has established the world by his wisdom and stretched out the heaven by his understanding. When he utters his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens. He causes the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He makes lightnings for the rain. He brings the wind out of his treasuries. The God that judged Babylon made the heavens and the earth. The least Israelite, the Israelite of little account who knew the God of heaven, knew far more than the cleverest priest of Babylon or Egypt. And Babylon would be judged by the God who established the world by his wisdom. Jeremiah continues, everyone is dull-hearted and without knowledge. That's what Jeremiah said of Babylon. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Before the face of Jesus they are dumb. We're told of Solomon, he was, in verse 31, wiser than all men. In one respect, that is not difficult, seeing as all men are foolish. Says the Apostle Paul to the Romans in chapter 1 and verse 22, professing to be wise, they became fools. And yet even of the cleverest, Solomon was greater. The text then intriguingly gives us some of the names of the wise men of that day. Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, Chalcol and Darda, the sons of Mahol. Commentators and scholars are intrigued by these names and they try to work out who they are. And it's true that those names do appear in the Bible elsewhere. In 2 Chronicles 2 and verse 6 we read, and the sons of Zerah, Zimri and Ethan and Heman, Chalcol and Dara, five of them in all. So these people who are named, might refer to men of Judah, fellow Israelites, perhaps of a former generation. Or they might be contemporaries of Solomon, who share the names with the men of Judah, famed for their ideas and spiritual insight. Ahiman the Ezrahite writes Psalm 88. Was it the same man? We do not know. These may have been godly men whose wisdom was still nevertheless inferior to that of Solomon. Or they might have been worldly wise pagans from Egypt and Mesopotamia, or Israelites who had studied at their schools of thought. We do not know what their wisdom was. The fact that we don't know who they are, much less what they taught, is the pudding's proof. We continue to talk of Solomon and his wisdom, but these men are largely forgotten, their words not remembered. What did they teach? We do not know. But to whoever originally read this document, they probably were familiar with Heman and Chalcol and Dada. And the point made is that, you know, who's clever? On your top five cleverest people, who would you name? Well, Solomon is greater even than them. He is wiser than all men, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. So his nation is enlarged, but the extent of his wisdom goes even further. He is famous for it. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. This tells us not just of the extent of his wisdom, but the variety of how, of the means by which he could apply that wisdom. Some of us are good at some things and poor at others. Some people, annoyingly, are good at everything. Some of us don't feel to be good at anything in particular. But whatever Solomon puts his hand to, he prospers because of his God. His wisdom extends to ethics and morality, and many of those proverbs, of course, are recorded in the book of Proverbs in the Bible. And yet, he who was good at ethics and pithy, wise observations was also rather splendid at music and romance, and of course we have the Song of Solomon recorded. He's an all-rounder because of his God. Remember how verse 29 set the scene. God made Solomon wise. I sometimes think, when we are good at something, we give the glory to ourselves as though we made ourselves that way. That at which you excel, for that give the glory to God. We're told he spoke of trees, from the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. So he's good at ethics, he's good at music. Now he's doing rather well at biology. From the greatest of trees, those cedars of Lebanon, to the smallest of wild flowers, shooting out of a wall, nothing escapes his notice and evades his interest. He can see the huge and the tiny. He can see that which is near and that which is far. He examines the rare as well as the common. He spoke also of animals, of birds, of creeping things, and of fish. He looks at things above. He looks at things below. Creatures on land, creatures of sea. He observes, he looks, he studies, he wonders. The natural world is teeming full of beauty and splendor, design and creativity. The Egyptians were wrong to worship crocodiles, cats and falcons. The Babylonians were foolish to worship the moon and the stars. And yet the animal world and the heavenly hosts above us point, do they not, to the very Creator. The Babylonians and the Egyptians looked at the signs and not to where the signs were pointing. Whereas the wise man looks at the created world and sees the Creator God to which it points. In Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verse 4, Solomon says, I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. Not only does he absorb all this wonderful knowledge which he has collected and obtained, but he creates these gorgeous gardens. The natural world which Solomon studied pointed to God. Psalm 19 famously says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through all the earth, and all their words to the end of the world. God gave us an inbuilt sense of curiosity that we might examine this wonderful world in which we live. You cannot find God by looking at trees and flowers. Though I dare say liberal clergymen will tell you that. You find God in the scriptures. And yet at the same time, the natural world points to God. How an atheist can climb a Lakeland fell and not think that a Creator God made it. Or behold the beauty of a wild flower, elegant in its simplicity, and not think an appreciator of beauty so made it. Or anyone can study the human body and think, yeah, it's obviously the result of random chance and blind forces operating. The heavens declare the glory of God. Man, says Paul, is without excuse. Men of all nations, from all the kings of the earth, who had heard of his wisdom, came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. Solomon was the kind of man who, if ever you heard him speaking about flowers or trees or animals, he would have made it so incredibly interesting. Many of us can remember from school that one or two very interesting teachers which make their subject come to life. I cannot but wonder that Solomon could speak on any subject and share with his hearer the passion and the pleasure which it gave him. And so men from all nations, sent by kings from all over the earth, went to hear. And so the fame of verse 31 results in the visitors mentioned in verse 34. We know one of them was Sheba's queen. We will come to her later. We know that Pharaoh was impressed by him. But once more, I think, we see in the person of Solomon a hint of the even better king of whom he was a shadow. The 2 millennia, men and women from all over the globe have been coming to Christ to hear and receive and accept his wisdom, both poor and rich, kings and peasants. And to this day, our great wise King of Kings extends an invitation, whosoever will may come. And yet we also know that Solomon's great wisdom made him unhappy. Now, wouldn't you think that the cleverer you are and the more you know, the happier and the more content you will be? My aunt phoned me the other day. She watches the news 3 times daily. And she phoned me up to say how perplexed and troubled she was, and I don't watch the news. And in my ignorance, I found bliss. And I wonder if the more we know, sometimes the less content we are. Let Solomon speak for himself once more in Ecclesiastes in chapter 1 and verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. And I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived this also is grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is much grief. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. The more we know, the more concerns us. And Solomon is making a spiritual point there. The more we know, the more sorrow increases. In Galatians chapter 3 and verse 24, Paul describes the moral law of God as being a tutor to bring us to Christ. In other words, the law of Moses is not just a list of ethical directions, but rather it is the means by which we become informed of our own sin. Before you know the gospel of Jesus Christ, you believe yourself to be a good person. And the gospel tells you you're sinful and wicked. You are the sow wallowing in the mud. You see, it's only when we understand the enormity of our sin that we realize our need for a gracious Savior. If you don't know you're a sinner, you won't think you have any need of Jesus Christ. you'll consider the cross of Calvary to be an interesting story, an inspirational story, the personification of love. But by it, you'll never be saved. Here is Solomon. He knows every tree and every flower, every star. The text doesn't say, but I imagine he knows a number of languages. He knows history. He knows ethics. He knows music. He has everything he could possibly want. And yet he describes his life as one of grief and one of sorrow. Perhaps Solomon was increasingly aware that though he was wise, he also had his heart within him, tugging him away from the doing the right thing to do and from the right path, that he might sin. At some point in the future, we know he gives in to that tugging. Furthermore, the more you know and the more you learn, the more horrified we become. We said before that, you know, some people are good at some things and good at others. I was good at history at school. One of the few things I can talk about with even a degree of, I was going to say a degree of expertise. I think that that's putting it too strongly. And I wonder if my mathematical abilities were lowered commensurately. I'm not sure. But you know, the more you study history, the more you realise and behold the utter depravity of a human heart. The cruelty. The suffering. Solomon, in his wisdom, beheld suffering and injustice and death. These wonderful trees and plants which he studied, eventually they would have grown old and died. For this wonderful world, so teeming with life, is besmirched and ruined by sin and the fall. And yet around this time, God moved Solomon's heart to construct the temple. Israel had the ark, and it was in the tabernacle, a model of which is in the upper room. And he writes to Hiram, king of Tyre, in 2 Chronicles chapter 2 and verse 3, "As you have dealt with David my father, and sent him cedars to build himself a house to dwell in, so deal with me. Behold, I am building a temple for the name of the Lord my God, to dedicate it to him, and to burn before him sweet incense for the continual showbread, for the burnt offerings morning and evening, on the Sabbaths, on the new moons, and on the set feasts of the Lord our God. This is an ordinance forever to Israel." Now we know that Solomon often points to Christ. So does and will the temple. And here is the wisest man, the man who should be the happiest man on earth. He has everything. But in Ecclesiastes, he confesses to being rather down. You see, we are ultimately spiritual creatures. And all the money in the world and all the fame and popularity, all the knowledge, all the respect can never satisfy your spirit. Week after week, people, often the poorest, buy lottery tickets because having all that money will give them the happiness they've always wanted but never had. And if they are unlucky enough to win, they'll be no happier. There'll just be more opportunities to experience grief. The only way you will find contentment is by having a sweet relationship with Jesus Christ. Now Solomon lived the best part of 1,000 years before Jesus came. And yet I wonder if God used the sorrow and grief which his great wisdom had provoked to seek Christ through the building of that temple. We know that David could not build it, and Solomon is the man. He has the resources, but without the bloody reputation. Why is hyssop mentioned? The cedar trees are huge, and they will, of course, be used in the construction of the temple. But why hyssop? Well, the point of the text, I think, is that whereas a cedar tree is huge and the hyssop is rather smaller, Solomon studied the big things and the little things. Yep. And yet hyssop in the scriptures speaks of sacrifice and purification. In the 12th of Exodus, when the children of Israel are about to be saved from the destroyer at Passover, Moses called all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go and select lambs for yourselves according to your clans and kill the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, dip it in the blood that is in the basin and touch the lintel and the two doorposts." In Leviticus 14, hyssop is mentioned again in the cleansing ceremony for the leper. In Numbers chapter 19, along with other ingredients, it's thrown into the fire for burning a heifer that is sacrificed. Again, when a person has died, the ashes of the sin offering, using the hyssop to sprinkle water, is put on all those who have touched the dead person. Say Psalm 51 and verse 7, "Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow." And in the 19th of John, when Jesus Christ is fastened to that cruel wooden cross, we're told now a vessel full of sour wine was sitting there, and they filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on hyssop, and put it to his mouth. It seems to me that hyssop is very strongly associated with purifying those who've been contaminated by death, and saving by the blood of the Lamb those who would die. And Solomon has spent his days examining the hyssop. And in the very next chapter, he is moved to build the temple. And Solomon, being wise, knew he could not be saved by animal sacrifice after animal sacrifice after animal sacrifice. The time would come, though I imagine he could only see it from afar and without even clear understanding for him, when the Lamb of God would come. The one to whom all those lambs that were slain and his blood was daubed over the lintels, he will come. And this temple which Solomon has been moved to construct is pointing to him. Solomon, for all his riches and happiness and splendor, he's not the happiest man on earth. For he cannot obtain the happiness without Christ. And he cannot obtain forgiveness of sin without Christ crucified. Christ came over 900 years after Solomon had died. I believe Solomon was saved by Christ. People who lived before him were saved by a future event. We who were born after him were saved by a past event. Old Testament saints and New Testament saints were saved by the cross of Calvary. And he who hung thereon, shedding his blood, that we who deserve the flames of hell might be admitted to the riches and splendors of heaven. We'll eventually come to the construction of the temple. But it's at the height of his wisdom that Solomon prepares for its construction. Whereas Solomon was looking forward to something he did not fully understand, we now look back upon something which we can understand far better. There are some things about the gospel I'll never quite comprehend. Why would he go through the agony for us? Why pay such a terrible price for such a people? Solomon beheld him from afar.